And turn to 1 Samuel then, chapter 21. David is on the lam. He's found out that Saul's hatred of him is greater than he even thought at the beginning, because of the little plan that he and Jonathan executed to discover Saul's intentions by having David miss the feast of the new moon. Well, after David discovered Saul's intention, he went to Nob, which is a city just a little south of Gibeah, and there he procured a few priestly provisions from Ahimelech, the priest. And those were, what were the two things he got from the priests? Tim? He got some bread, and he got a sword. Those were going to be two very important things. So the bread was to feed him, of course, on this journey, and the sword would be for some protection as he goes out. David has no idea quite yet what's going to happen to him, and he's in a very difficult situation. He's making decisions on the spur of the moment and just simply based on self-preservation. We know that the more stressful a situation is, the more your decisions simply become about the best way to almost just alleviate the stress. So when you're in life and death situations, your decisions are not, you're not thinking very long term in them. You're just trying to survive the next few seconds. And so we train our soldiers in battle. What are the best ways to avoid dying in the next 10 seconds? You know, take cover. You know, keep your head down. Things like this. You know, don't sit on the beach. You've got to move to get out of the line of fire. So sometimes you have to train people to do things that are contrary to our nature. Of course, if the bullets are flying, I know I would have been the guy curled up in a ball sitting in the waters on the beach at Normandy. I don't think I would have had the courage to run up that beach under fire to get cover at the base of the rocks. But when you're in those really stressful situations, your decision-making takes a definite change where you can't take the time to think about the long-term consequences of what you're doing. You're just making decisions quickly. And that's what David's going to do here in chapter 21. So he's got his sword from Ahimelech, and it's the sword of Goliath, and he heads off. We know from Jesus' commentary on this statement in Matthew chapter 12 that David does have some men with him. He's not completely alone, but he is on the run. And so we're going to pick up here in chapter 21, verse 10, with David, and we're going to look at hiding places tonight. That's our lesson for tonight, is hiding places. David rose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, whenever you see in Hebrew the CH, Hebrew doesn't have a ch sound. They have a kh. You got to kind of really like gurgle your throat if you want to make it right. So it's kh. Remember how we looked at David's wife's name? It was spelled M-I-C-H-A-L, and how do we pronounce that? It was Michal. Yeah, you got to get that almost. Michal. So this is Achish. All right, the king of Gath. All right, which nation is Gath in? Nope, it's not Israel. Philistia, yes. If you can note our map over here, all of these cities that are tightly bound together here are in Israel. Mostly this is Judah, okay? But you come over here, this area right about here is the edge of the mountainous region, and we get down into the flat, nice farmland coastal plains, and you run into Philistine territory. Okay? The Israelites dwell over here in the mountains, and the Philistines dwell over here in the flat coastal regions. Gath, one of the five major Philistine cities, is right here. Gath is some 25 miles away from Gibeah, or from Nob, all right? So it's a good day's journey if you're moving quickly to get from Gibeah to Gath. You could do it, probably it would have taken a couple of days. But we also know that David is fleeing, so he's not meandering and strolling and taking time to sniff the roses as he goes along this journey. It's rough land to cross those mountains. I should bring some of those pictures and scan them in, shouldn't I? We do a geography night. Part of our homeschooling is once every other week, Kim will, as we study a country, Kim will cook a meal that's sort of cuisine for that country. And we'll eat that and we'll study the country that night. We have, we're nerdy homeschoolers this way, but our tablecloth is clear so that you can see the world map underneath of it. All right, so we have a world map at our table. That way when we're sitting there at the evening eating our dinner and talking, we can discuss world events and say, so where is Germany, kids? And oh, there it is. It's under the green beans. And where's Israel? Oh, okay, you got to move the butter to find it. There it is. but we were having our Israeli meal. Where is that going with this? I'm not even sure. What's that? Pictures. Oh, yeah. So to learn about Israel, we pulled out some old memories for me because 16 years ago I went to Israel and took a whole bunch of pictures. This was back when we had 35 millimeter cameras. Anybody remember those? My good friend of mine had one of the first digital cameras on this trip, and he thought it was just awesome. He said, Brian, I'm gonna get such better pictures than you. And these were the old digital cameras where the resolution was really low. And, you know, you take a picture and you say, well, I'm not sure, is that Jerusalem or is that a bumblebee? I can't quite tell what it is. And he had to carry, this will date me too. How many of you remember the 3.5-inch floppy disks? They were like solid disks. They had a little metal slidey thing. You had to stick one of those in the camera, and it could hold 3 or 4 pictures on that. And so he kept teasing me about how great his camera was, and I just had this old 35 millimeter with a telephoto lens, and I said, yeah, but Jimmy, one roll of film, I can get 30 pictures on it, and you got to carry around this huge big fanny pack full of floppy disks and keep sort of which ones are full and which ones are empty. And I think I brought back 30 rolls of film from Israel that year, and most of them I didn't get developed, actually. So, but I do have lots of pictures, so we sat down and, you know, flipped through photographs, which you don't do with kids anymore. You have to swipe on your phone and look at this, kids. And, you know, so anyway, pictures. Yeah, I was going to show you pictures of Israel. You can sort of tell by this map that you can see the little darker shaded areas are kind of greenish. That's farmland. That's things growing. When, well, you notice over here it's all nice and bright white. That's because there is nothing growing there, okay? It's a very mountainous region. It's very desolate and barren. I will say this. I don't know if I've related this story to you before or not, but I watched a devotional series of going through the Holy Land and trying to help us in our understanding of Scripture. And this man is standing on a mountain in southern Judah, and he's pointing over the wasteland that is southern Judah. Nothing grows there in the summertime because it's 130, 135 degrees, and there is zero rain from about March until November, okay? So nothing grows. It's just rocky. It's really tall hills, steep valleys, and it's just a mess. In the wintertime, when you do get some rains, you get these scraggly bushes that grow up, but they don't last very long. And so we're looking in this video, he's looking out over this barren wasteland, and you see these little scraggly bushes growing up here and there, and he says, this is Psalm 23. These are the green pastures that David's talking about. I said, wow, what a disappointment. If that's the green pastures that God said he's leading us to in Psalm 23. But I listened to that for a little while, and I thought, well, it kind of makes sense. But then something dawned on me years later to say, the Holy Land is not what it once was for several reasons. One of those is that Israel is not living in the land under the blessing of God, right? Oh, they're living there now, and they're revitalizing that land, and it's amazing, but they're not there under the blessings of the covenant, which promised just bountiful provision from God. When you read the Mosaic Covenant, it was promises, if you obey me, you know, your calves will never miscarry. You're going to be abundant. It's going to be a land flowing with milk and honey. And it was, as long as they were obedient. Right now, Israel is living in disobedience because they haven't received Christ as their Messiah. And so the land is not being abundantly blessed by God. Number two, while it's not being abundantly blessed by God, it has also been under constant war for the last 2,000 years. And guess what they do in a war? So if you're coming to siege Jerusalem, where are you going to get all your machinery? Well, in ancient war, you didn't ship it in like we do today. You cut down the trees and you built it once you got there. And so when they would come in to destroy Jerusalem, they would also kill every tree within 3 miles to build their siege works. So this land has been just torn apart by war. So I really think that for those two reasons alone, the Holy Land does not today look like what it did in David's day either. So, you know, David's day 3,000 years ago, I think the green pastures were probably very green. Okay, and the land was still abundantly blessed by God because Israel was living there. It's going to be amazing. We're going to see that again when Israel finally comes to faith in the Messiah and Christ rules over the world from Jerusalem, and that river flows out of Jerusalem to water everything, and the Dead Sea becomes fresh water. That's going to be an amazing time when we see God's blessings poured out in that place again. So anyway, you're looking over this place, and it's just desolate, desolate wasteland, and this is the what David is traveling through. So he flees from Gibeah, which is underneath all of these names. It's right about here where that hand is at, and he fled all the way over here to Gath. Now we have to stop for just a moment and use our sanctified imaginations as to why David would go to the Philistines. What's David known for? Killing Goliath, who was a Philistine. And not just any Philistine, he was the champion of the Philistines. And David's slaying of Goliath really defeated the power of the Philistines during that day. So I'm really at a bit of a loss as to understand why David is taking this route to go to Achish, the king of Gath. Why you would flee from Saul and go to Saul's worst enemy. The only thing that I can think of is that he hoped that because he is now an enemy of Saul, he might find some respite with Saul's enemy. Okay? But it's not going to be the case, because we'll see what happens when he gets there. This section of the text is summarized. Probably a lot happens here that we don't get told about, but what we do get told is pretty important. Because David, hoping to find some protection and some respite there in Philistia, finds just the opposite. The servants of Achish said to him, "Is not this David?" And what's the next thing they say about him? "The king of the land." Now let's stop and think, which presidential cycle are we in here in Israel? Who's the king? Saul is the king. But who do they call the king? Well, let's put it this way. Who's actually sitting on the throne and reigning? We've said that's Saul. In God's eyes, who's the king? David. Okay, he's been anointed. The Spirit of God is resting upon David. And David has spent his entire career building his own reputation, well, not purposely building his own reputation, but God has been working through him in such a mighty way that all the people of Israel recognize who's really making things move in the nation. It does happen sometimes that the powerhouse of a nation, the real leader of men in the nation, is not the head of the nation. That happens at times, doesn't it? So the one that's actually making things happen is not the real leader. And that's what's happening here. And so when he gets to Gath, hoping to find some protection and hoping to find some respite and probably hoping to find some anonymity, he gets there and realizes just the opposite. They know who he is. And they know the things that he has done. David has defeated the Philistines in many battles. Not only did he defeat Goliath, what did he do to win the hand of Saul's daughter, Michal? Okay, Tim? Yeah, took 200 foreskins of Philistine soldiers. We said that was not only a defeat for them, it was a humiliation. So you can imagine when the other Philistine soldiers found their comrades not only dead from battle, but also mutilated and humiliated after they were killed, that stuck with them. So not only do they recognize who David is, they recognize that he's really the one that's making events happen in Israel, and they call him the king of the land. Is this not David, the king of the land? And they also remember something else about the battle with Goliath, and that is the song that the Israelite ladies sang to David as he was coming home from the battle. And there's a key point about this song that sticks with them and with us. "Did they not sing to one another of him in dances, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his tens thousands. So even in the song, David gets commemorated as the real leader. He's the one that's making stuff happen. He's the one that's moving events in Israel. And they recognize this. And they say, this is David. He's the one that's really ruling the land, even when Saul's the king. We had periods like that in English history, where you had one king sitting on the throne, but, you know, what is that? The Duke of Buckingham was really the one calling all the shots and making things go on. So they said, look, this is David. He's the one that's really doing all this. So all the defeats that we have suffered at Israelite hands are because of that guy. Now David recognizes something here. Verse 12, David took these words to heart. And how do you think he feels about that? You don't have to think, do you? It tells us. How does David feel about hearing of his reputation in Philistia? He was much afraid. Now, why is he afraid? He's going to get swamped with fan mail, right? Or hate mail, maybe. Okay, this is not the civilized 21st century where if we have enemies, we just debate with them and do diplomacy ad infinitum. This is the ancient world where you defeat your enemies by making sure they can't talk back to you. Okay. And so you defeat your enemies by killing them. So David is rightfully terrified here at what's going to happen to him because he realizes they know who he is and the way that they're going to overcome who he is to kill him. And he is not well protected at this point. He has a few people with him. He might have just a handful of men that have followed him into exile, but him versus the entire Philistine army doesn't look like good odds. Okay. Doesn't look like good odds. So here's his solution. He was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Verse 13, he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands and made marks on the doors of the gates and let his spittle run down his beard. Okay. He changed his behavior. So obviously as he's coming into the city, he's in his right mind, and they can tell that. But once he hears what everybody's saying and he sort of catches the rumors that are drifting around the royal court in Gath, he formulates this plan. I'd better make some changes here. So maybe he starts rolling his eyes funny and says he starts marking on the doorpost. So as they're holding him, says they've got their hands on him, as they're holding him probably up against the door to see what the king wants to do with David, he starts scribbling on the doorposts, and he starts letting spit run down his beard. He's trying to impersonate a madman, someone that's just completely lost his mind. Okay? And that's his plan. That's how he's going to get out of this. His hope is that the king will not bother to waste a sword stroke on a crazy person. Okay. And it's a bit of a long shot. This really is a last gap, or a last, last ditch? Yeah, last ditch effort on David's part, because they really could say, well, if he's just a crazy man, let's just end it for him. Who needs this guy running around? Okay. And so it's a last ditch effort. In verse 14, then Achish said to his servants, behold, you see, the man is mad. Why then have you brought him to me? Do I lack madmen? You got to love this admission, don't you? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this fellow to behave as a madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? And the answer they're expecting to that question is, no. No, we don't need any more madmen here. We've got plenty of them. Okay. So Achish sends him away. I want you to turn to Psalm chapter 34. Because as you start to think, David is probably thinking at some point, God, what are you doing in my life? You told me I was going to be king, and yet here I am, I'm running and I'm fleeing in exile. Not only am I in danger of my life in my own country, in my own hometown, I'm in danger of my life to any country I go to. What am I supposed to do? Look at Psalm 34. When was this psalm written? When he changed his behavior before before Abimelech. You got to understand, Abimelech is a title. Okay, Achish is probably his name, but Abimelech is a title. It means, actually, my father is king. Okay, Abi means my father, and Melech is the Hebrew word for king. And the ancient kings used to like to claim that the gods were their fathers. It kind of gave them a legitimacy in the minds of the people. Say, well, if God's his father, and they're not talking about our God, they're talking about the God of the Philistines, which would have been Dagon. Okay. My father is the king. So they would call themselves sons of the God, actually, to claim legitimacy for their rule. But when he changed his behavior before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt his name together. Why do you think he's in such a state of praising God's name? Because he's still alive, right? Yeah, I'm not in Gath, and I'm still alive, because there was a time there where David really thought his life was over in the hands of Achish. Verse 4, he says, I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and delivered me from all my fears. Well, those fears of being killed by Achish. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. Here's this idea of radiance is not like shining with light, but shining with confidence. Shining with that confidence that only comes from being proved right. So how many of you, you're ever in an argument and you say, no, I think it's this way. And you know, your opponent says, no, it's this way. So maybe it's your wife and you know, you're saying, oh, no, this is really this way. And she says, I don't think so. I think it's the other way. And then you find out she was right. Right? And of course, her face is beaming with pride. And she says, I told you that's the way it was. And you're right. Okay, that kind of beaming that comes with finding out you're right. Well, what does David say he found out he was right about? What was he right about? Yeah, trusting God. He went to God with this problem. God, I'm terrified. I'm about to die. Help me. And God did it. And so he says, you know, those who look to him are radiant. Those who trust God, they will never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. So if the angel of the Lord encamps around you, how safe are you? You're pretty safe. There's nothing that's going to touch you. There's nothing that's going to harm you. David is expressing his praise to God because he says, I realize now that if somebody trusts in God to take care of him, there is absolutely nothing that can touch them. Nothing. Nothing outside of God's will can harm you. Not even the king of Gath. Okay? Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for those who fear him have no lack. God provides. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? How many of you want life and you want to see many days and you want to see good for many days? That is pretty much all of us. So he's going to tell us how you get that. Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. You do what's right. David says that's what's going to bring long, good days. Because, verse 15, the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous and his ears toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Was David brokenhearted? He just had to flee from his own country because his king, his father-in-law, wants him dead. Yeah, David was brokenhearted. He was terrified. He was crushed in spirit. But he says, I learned from this situation in Gath that God is near to those who are brokenhearted. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Now pay attention to this next verse, because I think you've heard it before. He keeps all his bones, and not one of them is broken. Where do we see that verse again? Say it again. on the cross. Jesus hung on that cross, but not one of his bones was broken because it fulfilled a prophecy that David wrote after he got away from Achish. And so as David is fleeing in great grief and he makes this decision, let's go to Philistia, and we could say, maybe not a great decision. But look at what God accomplished through it. But because of David's flight to Achish, because God saved David before Achish, David's able to write this psalm and not only understand how God acts toward his people, that God is going to deliver his people, God is going to save his people to such an extent that he says not one of their bones will be broken. That's how safe you are. Because if God says not one of your bones will be broken, then not one of your bones will be broken. Because the angel of the Lord encamps around you. Ultimately, that is perfectly fulfilled in the person of Christ. Because how many times did they try to kill him and they couldn't? It was more than once. His own people in Nazareth tried to push him off a cliff, and he got through the midst of them because God protected him. They picked up stones when he said, I and my Father are one. They couldn't touch him. And even when he hung on the cross, as brutal as the Romans were to people hanging on the cross, they couldn't even break a bone of his body because God said, you're not going to touch him that way. I let you kill him because it was necessary that he die, but you're not going to mutilate him. Not like that. And David writes this prophecy. Isn't it great how God works through things? The stuff in our life that we think is the most horrible experiences, the stuff in our life that we think is the worst things to go through, that's what God is working through. Not only to grow us, but to accomplish his own purposes. Because of what David went through there at Gath, we have Psalm 34, and we have the promise that none of Christ's bones would ever be broken. We have that fulfillment of prophecy that shows us that Jesus is the one that had been spoken of. What great things our God is able to accomplish by weaving all the little threads of life together into his grand tapestry. Well, David's not done. He makes another decision now that he's free from Gath. So chapter 22, verse 1. David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Now we want to note here on our map that Adullam is somewhere in here. Yeah? I'm circling the whole thing. We have no idea where this cave is at. It's one of the caves. There are many, many caves, especially in this southern area of Judah. There is a town right here called Adullam, but we don't think he went to the town of Adullam. Okay? Because from later references to this place, it apparently is in the wilderness. It's out in the middle of nowhere, okay? Not near a town. So somewhere in this wilderness, probably south of Jerusalem, is a cave called Adullam, and we don't know where it's at. But David goes there for a little while, and we don't know how long. David is going to be on the run from Saul for years. He was only a couple of days to get to Gath, and probably he's at Adullam maybe a week after his flight. So the last few chapters have happened very quickly. Within just a couple, 3 weeks worth of time, David has found out the king wants him dead, and he's fled. And now where he had been living in a very comfortable palace as the son-in-law to the king and as the commander of the armies of Israel, he is now living in exile, sleeping in a cave with just a handful of people for company. It's a distressing time for David. But second half of verse 1 there, when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down to him. Now, why do you think his family went down to him? They're probably not safe in Bethlehem either. Saul's rage is extending to completely destroy David, and it was not uncommon in those times to not only wipe out your political opponent, but also his family. Every possible connection to him. And so it was very, very likely that Saul would have gone after David's family. But they come down to the cave, wherever it's at. They find out where he is. And that tells us that some time has passed, enough time for some communications to pass back and forth. And I don't think that David posted on his Facebook page, say, really sad today, update my status, really sad today, hiding in the cave 3 miles southwest of, you know. News had to travel, and it took some time. So we've got probably several months here, but David, finally his family comes to him, his brothers and all his father's house, and they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him. Misery loves company, doesn't it? So here's poor David in the exile, experiencing all this pain and woe, and who gathers to him? Everybody else that's experiencing pain and woe. Wouldn't that be encouraging? Yeah. You'd love to have somebody just come alongside you and say, it's okay, David. God's going to work it out. All things work together for good, David. Just hang in there. Everything comes to pass. This too shall pass. Just hang on. Keep your faith. It's going to be okay. But that's not what happens. I lost it. Well, that's okay. We'll let it just flop around there and see. But that's not what happens. And who comes to him are all the people that are saying, yeah, you're right. Life stinks. This is awful. I'm in debt. I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And so I'm just going to run from it. I'm not going to pay it back. Oh, that's the kind of company you want to keep with, isn't it? All the political dissidents, yeah, you're right, that's Saul. He's the worst king we've ever had. We need to boot him out of office. Okay. All these sorts of people, the malcontents, the discontents, the complainers, the whiners, those are the people that are gathering around him. Everyone who is bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became captain over them. And there were about 400 men. Now think back to just last chapter, last week. What did David have to do to get bread? He had to show up at the temple and say, have you got any bread? And the only thing they had was to give him the holy bread. And that was for just him and a couple other guys. Now he's got 400 people to take care of. Go on. You try to go on vacation. Try to get away from it for a little bit. Get some rest and relaxation, and all these people follow you. And not only are they the whiners and complainers of the nation, but you've also got to feed them now. Okay. David's spot is fairly tough from here. But I want to take you to another passage of Scripture that this is going to enlighten us as to what's going on here. You say, what is God doing? Why is God just doing this stuff to David? It seems like he's just trying to smash him into the dirt. Like, what, you know, you gave David this promise that you're going to make him king, and look how you're treating him. Why would you do this to him? And that's our tendency. He said, God, why? Why are you? I don't get it. Okay, but I want to take you to, go to 1 Chronicles, chapter 11. Oops, I'm passing it. We're right at the end of those lovely genealogies that are so encouraging for all of us. Verse 15. 1 Chronicles 11:15. Three of the 30 chief men. Now I'm going to stop here and explain a little bit about what's going on. We are right at the beginning of David's kingdom in 1 Chronicles, okay? And the chronicler is outlining for us David's government. Who's in charge of what? Now, if you have read through the Chronicles in your devotions, then you've come across this section that talked about David's mighty men. Okay. These were the chief soldiers. These were the guys in charge of the military. These were his tough guys. These were the fellows he sent on the hardest missions. And it delineated some of them. So he had a group of mighty men that was 30. But of that 30, there were three that were just supermen almost, okay? And I want you to notice where he met these three guys, okay? Verse 15, three of the 30 chief men, where did he meet them? At the cave, at Adullam. You see what God's connecting here? David can't see it when he's in the cave, but these three of these guys, three of those 400, are going to become so intrinsic to David that he's going to make them rulers within Judah and Israel when David becomes king. They went down to the rock at David at the cave of Adullam, where the army of the Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim, and that's up near Bethlehem. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then at Bethlehem. I want you to notice something else that's happening with David with these men at the cave. So they come down to him, and when they come down, it says they're malcontents, they're in debt, they hate life, they're distressed in spirit. But I want you to notice what David develops in these men during his time in the cave. David, verse 17, said longingly, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that's by the gate." So David's in exile at this cave, and in a moment of nostalgia says, "I remember as a little boy drinking water out of that well at Bethlehem. Boy, would I just love to have some of that water again." And look what these three guys do. "Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines." Three guys against the entire Philistine army. Okay, broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water out of the well. So not only that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. So not only do they go through the Philistine army once, they get a cup of water and they go back through. So they're penetrating the Philistine line two times. They brought it to David. You notice the loyalty that these guys have towards David? Look at what he's developing. David's going to become king. God is going to fulfill his promise. I mean, from the standpoint that we're at in the text, he's in exile. It looks bad. But look at what God's accomplishing during these rough times. David is learning about who God is, and he learned during his stay at Gath that if I don't trust God and only God, I'm never going to make it. And God is the only one who can protect me. And he learns that lesson very well, and he writes a psalm about it. Now he's at the cave, and he's learning the lessons of leading people. Not just to tell them what to do, not just to get what you want, but look at what he's developing in these men. They come to him as malcontents. They come to him as people in debt. They come to him as people that won't fulfill their obligations. Okay? Because really, they're running from their debt. They don't want to pay it back. So they just let the bank foreclose on all their houses or whatever it was they owed, and they came to David to escape that. And he develops in them leadership skills that will be necessary to rule a nation. And he develops in them a fierce loyalty where they're willing to risk their lives just to get him a cup of water. And he realizes what a valuable thing that is. Look at what he does with the water. David would not drink it, but he poured it out to the Lord and said, "Far be it from me before my God that I should do this. Shall I drink the lifeblood of these men? For at the risk of their lives they brought it." Therefore he would not drink it. These things did the three mighty men, three of these guys that came down to him at the cave of Adullam. Now Kim and I have talked about what an insult to these guys. They risk their lives to bring you a glass of water. And how would you react if you just went through all that and you gave it to David and he said, "Oh, I can't drink it," out on the ground? So, I'm thirsty, let me drink it. But can you imagine if David had drank it? How much more willing would those guys be to do that again and risk their lives? And I think in that one moment, he pours it out as an offering to God, not only recognizing what God was accomplishing in him or through him in these guys' lives, but also recognizing his responsibility as a leader not to throw their lives away. Because maybe next time he utters something and says, "Oh, boy, I really wish I could have some lamb chops from that cafe way up there in northern Judah. You know, the place out on Main Street makes the best, you know, fried or best ribs, lamb ribs." And they say, "Oh, there's another idea. Let's go get it for him." So David's really, he's teaching his men. He's learning how to lead. And this time in Adullam that seems like such a crazy thing. Seems like you're saying, "God, where are you? What are you doing all this for?" God was working in David to develop in him the skills he needed to be the king. And he's developing in the people that are following David a loyalty to David because of the man that he is. Well, he's got another move, another hiding place from Adullam. Once he's got these 400 guys, verse 3, David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. Now, my map is up there. I'm going to zoom out just a little bit so that you can see where Moab is. Moab is this region here, and it stretches from right about here all the way up to this creek right there. Okay. Where in Moab this place is at, we're not sure. Very likely it's right here on the border because the word Mizpah means a fortress, some kind of a protected place. And so it might be on the border between Israel, who lived up here, and Moab, who lived down here. All right. So he goes to Moab. Now, what connection does David have to Moab? other than being an Israelite who don't like Moabites. Everybody's scratching their head. No? Ruth. Remember great-grandma Ruth? David's grandma? Okay. She's a Moabite. Moabitess. David is personally connected to this kingdom. And so that gives him an inroad to be able to go back there and make this request that he does. So he goes back to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me." Who's he seeking now? Now he's seeking God. When he ran into Gath, he was just making split-moment decisions. He was just flying off the cuff. But now he's calmed down a little bit, he's got things a little more under control, and he's able to stop and say, "I've got to wait and see what God's going to do, and until that happens, I need you to take care of my family." And so he puts his parents and his brothers in protective custody of the king of Moab. But look at what happens next. He left them there with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. So David goes back to the stronghold, leaving his parents and his family there in safety at Moab. And there is some time that's going on there. But there's a problem. The prophet Gad said to David, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." See, here David is waiting for God's direction. He's waiting for God's instruction into his life because he's learning this lesson to let God lead him in everything. Okay, David's faith as a young man to be able to challenge Goliath was great. But it needs to be deeper. And so when he ran to Gath, he wasn't exercising faith, he was running in fear. And when he went to Moab and was hiding in Moab, he wasn't completely exercising his own advice when he said in Psalm 34, "Those that trust in the Lord, their faces shine." Because he's trusting in the king of Moab. And he's looking for what God wants him to do, but God's going to call him at this point to put his trust in God and God alone, because where does he tell him to go? Back home. "I want you to go back to Judah." Say, "Well, maybe I didn't hear you right, Lord. You know who lives very close to Judah? Saul. Maybe you've heard of him, Lord, this guy that wants to kill me, my father-in-law. Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." But look at David's response. And this is a response that I don't think he would have had except for what God taught him during his time in Gath and during his time in this cave at Adullam. It says, as soon as he gets this command, leave the safety, leave the security of Moab, leave everything there and go back to Judah, where you're going to be threatened again, where you're going to be unprotected, where you're going to have to trust me and only me, the Lord says. And David's response is, David departed and went into the forest of Herith. Now, Herith is another place, we don't know where it's at. But Judah is only a few hours away from Gibeah, the palace of Saul. And so here God leads David. Once David has finally gotten to the point where he's willing to listen to God's voice and follow God's instruction, to do it without question, God leads him right back into a place of danger, because David has got to learn what he has already written, that if God says nobody's going to break a bone of your body, then it won't happen. And so here's David in his hiding places. Some of them he went to in his own wisdom and in his own strength. But God redirected him. Because in those hiding places, David learned to follow God's lead. And David's learning a lot of character traits that he's going to need as a king. God's going to lead us through some difficult spots, folks. He never promised things to be easy. He never promised our lives to be rosy. In fact, he almost tells us the opposite, that we're going to go through awful, difficult times because our faith grows in adversity. Our faith is strengthened in the fires of trials. We don't grow too much when things are easy. We get complacent. We get unthankful. It's like sitting in the air condition all day long and then you step outside into the 85-degree day. How's it feel? "Oh, it's stifling out here." Well, you know what? If you spend all day out in 85, then it doesn't feel that bad, does it? Faith grows through adversity. So when God takes you to those hiding places, when God puts you in places that are tough, hang on, because He is accomplishing great things. He's growing you. And you never know what He's accomplishing through you down the road. What will events of your life right now will impact in somebody else's life, maybe years from now. 2,000 years or 1,000 years after David wrote that psalm, the New Testament writers said, now we get it. Jesus is the one that was being talked about because none of His bones were broken. And 2,000 years after that, we read that psalm and say, I get it. Jesus is the one the Old Testament was pointing to. And it was because David was used by God to write those words after he was going to those hiding places. Let's pray together.